The following live presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman is brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To learn more about Israelite, please visit our website at www.israelite.org. Additional contact information is available at the end of this presentation. Thank you for learning with Israelite and enjoy the experience.
So I came to Israel when I was 18, right after high school. And I basically came to learn for a year, which I highly recommend. And I basically fell in love with the country. I stayed Shana Bet, a second year. And then there was a war on, so I decided to stay and to join up. I went into the army. Make a long story short, I ended up in the army for about 4.5 years. Became an officer. And I've been doing reserves here for the last 20 years. I run a program called Israelite in the Old City. We also have stuff in New York, actually. And in Florida and Los Angeles. Basically an educational program. And the fact that I'm talking to you about Yom HaTzmaut, about Independence Day, Memorial Day, in uniform is a total coincidence. I'm just in the middle of reserve duty and managed to finagle my way to be able to do this with you. I have to go back to the Army tonight. Wanted to maybe share with you a couple things. I want to give you two rules, okay, for this discussion. First of all, because this is on the one hand such a distance and, you know, it's a little more difficult to interact, I'm going to take you back to third grade. If you have a question or you want, you know, to share something or whatever, so feel free to raise your hand. If I see you raise your hand, I'll stop and I'll, you know, or finish a sentence and if you have a question. And I also have a couple questions. I'm actually very curious to hear what you think about this. And I'm going to try to leave some time at the end for like maybe a little more of an open Q&A forum. You know, anything that's on your mind. It could be about what we're going to talk about. It could be about Israel in general, about the army, whatever you want, okay? So while we're talking, you know, keep in mind, if you have something that you think you have an opportunity, it's not every day you get to meet a guy who's a company commander in the army. If you have questions, you'll have a chance, you know, sort of at the end to maybe a little back and forth. We're going through, this is a very, on the one hand, difficult time in Israel for a lot of different reasons. For the first time, you know, that I can remember, the specter of whether, you know, or sort of what will be with the state of Israel going forward has risen again on a number of different levels. This country, and I have to be very careful, you know, sort of what I say over an open line here. You'll have to come to visit me to have a more frank discussion. But, you know, it's pretty clear to those who are in the know here in Israel that it's only a matter of time before things heat up again. There are all sorts of plans in the army for, you know, sort of what might be this summer, especially sort of in the area that was Gush Katif, Gaza, the Gaza Strip. Hamas and the PA are building up, unfortunately, in a very serious way. The northern border, even though it may not be in the news as much, is also undergoing a lot of hot zones. Hezbollah is basically rebuilding its entire infrastructure, etc. And when you add to that sort of what's going on in Iran, or what might be going on in Iran, and what's going on in Syria, and some of the terrorist threats that we have in terms of you know, complications down in Egypt, and the fact that America is considering arming Saudi Arabia and all sorts of other things that are going on, this is a very tenuous time, right? And, you know, putting aside the fact that, you know, sort of at the end of the day, Hashem runs the world, and, you know, you can't get stressed about these things, but it certainly raises some interesting questions. And also in terms of the calendar, you know, this coming, it would have been Sunday, but in Israel they never start this thing on Sunday, only because that way people don't have to prepare for it on Shabbat. So basically this Monday and Tuesday, Israel will commemorate on Monday, really Sunday night, Memorial Day, what we call Yom HaZikaron, the Day of Remembrance. And then of course on Monday night and Tuesday, Yom HaTzmaut, Independence Day. And that's a very, very difficult transition. I don't know anyone in this country who doesn't have someone, either that they lost personally or that they know, or someone they know who lost someone personally. Monday morning, at 11 o'clock in the morning, this entire country will stop. The sirens will go off. In fact, there's a special siren that differs from a war siren, so that you would know if it was a, you know, sort of an emergency siren or the siren for Yom HaZikaron. And everybody just stops. Cars stop on the highway and get out and stand at attention. radio, television, everywhere you go, people standing in restaurants stop eating and stand up at attention. They walk out onto the streets. Tens and tens of thousands of people crowd into the military cemetery all over the country to remember those who sort of gave so much so that we could have a state to celebrate. This particular, you know, usually I actually go to Har Herzl in Yerushalayim, which is the National Military Cemetery in Israel. I guess you could call it the equivalent of Arlington, because I have a couple of good friends who are buried there. This year I'm actually going to be in Ra'anana. And maybe this is appropriate time. I want to actually dedicate this shiur, this discussion. When I came to Israel, so I really didn't have anybody here. I mean, I grew up in America. My family was in America. So I was what was called a chayal boded, which meant that I went into the army as a lone soldier. Not an easy thing to do. And about a year after I went into the army, cousins of mine from England made aliyah in 1984, and they went to Ra'anana. And their son Benji, who was 4 years old, I was basically the first live Israeli soldier he ever met. And we all became we were cousins, so we were already close, but we became very close. Every time I got out for Shabbos, most of the time, I went to this family. And he grew up, you know, really as an Israeli, although he speaks perfect English. And last summer, at the end of June, he actually got married, 27 years old. He became a company commander in probably one of the most elite units in the Israeli army, a unit called Egoz. This is a unit that was started after the first Lebanon War, after we pulled out, actually, of Lebanon in 2000. And its mission was basically to go into Lebanon undercover and to deal with the Hezbollah and all sorts of stuff like that. And he became a company commander, which is a serious rank. It's a rank of captain, whatever, three bars. And he married his high school sweetheart. I mean, they'd been going out, I don't know, for about 8 years. And, you know, it was an incredible simcha. The whole family got together. I remember there was a particular moment at the wedding where he kind of grabbed the mic, you know, and his bride, his, you know, Ayala, was basically sitting in a chair. Gorgeous girl. He cuts a very striking figure. They were like something out of the storybooks. And he grabbed the mic and he started singing. He started serenading her. The song, whatever, that was from when they were going out. And I have this image of her face. Just pure joy. You know, everybody's laughing, having an amazing time. About 4 weeks to the day after that wedding, we all got together again. Only this time we got together at his funeral. He was killed in one of the missions in Marun Aras, in one of the villages in southern Lebanon. Actually, as part of a mission to try to, you know, come to the aid of a paratrooper unit that was surrounded. And he was killed by an anti-tank shell. The image of his bride prostrate over the grave in black, just completely wrecked, just a destroyed human being. That same girl who had been at the pinnacle of joy just 4 weeks earlier will stay with me forever. And to me, on a certain level, that represents really the story of the Jewish people and the challenge that we have. You know? I mean, when you say Birkat HaMazon, you know, when you say the grace after meals, right? So there's a mizmor, there's a psalm from Tehillim, from the Psalms, that we say, Shir HaMalot, right? And it says, you know, Az Yimaleh Schok Pinu, then will our mouths be filled with laughter. Do you ever wonder why when redemption comes, when Geulah comes, you'll laugh? Because what is laughter? Laughter is the unexpected. You know, it's like, I don't know, you see a grown man. I mean, if your Rebbe slipped on a banana peel or walked in a ballet outfit, it'd be funny because it's like so unexpected, right? So I remember, whatever. So it'll be so unexpected when we come back to Israel. Yeah, right. It'll be so unexpected when we come back to Israel, right? I mean, if you would have told somebody sitting in the shadows of Auschwitz-Birkenau in 1945, that 3 years later, Jews would be dancing in the streets as they declared a state of Israel, he would have told you were nuts. And yet there we were. You know? 1 minute, we're on top of the world. That's the story of Yosef. 1 minute, he's on top of the world. He's in his technicolor coat, his ketonet pasim. He's going to see his brothers. Dad, Yaakov, finally let him out to go hang with the guys. And the next minute, he's in a pit. Right? V'aborek en bo mayim, there's no water in it. And Rashi says, aval nechashim v'akravim yesh bo, that it's full of scorpions and snakes. 1 minute you're on top of the world, and the next minute you're in a pit. Right? That was the Jews in Nazi Germany. 1 minute they were given rights, they were even allowed to own land for the first time in hundreds of years in Europe. And the next minute, they're putting them into cattle cars and giving them numbers on their arms. and you kind of take a step back. And it makes you wonder, what is this all for? You know, and where are we today? You know, I remember I was on reserve duty. This is in the first Intifada, which was like sort of an armed uprising all over Yudan Shomron, the territories here in Israel. And we were stationed in Ramallah, which is a city just north of Yerushalayim. Used to be that's where Arafat has had his headquarters. And this was really a hot zone. And our gizra, our sector, was a couple of refugee camps, Al-Amari, whatever. And sometimes at night we would get a notice that they were looking for a particular wanted terrorist, and that they had intelligence that he was in a particular area, wherever in Ramallah. And there was always a shabaknik, the Shirut Bitachon Klali, that's the sort of Israeli, I don't know, undercover, whatever you want to call them, right? And these guys are unbelievable. You could pass by them in the street, you would have no idea they're Jewish. They speak perfect Arabic, they look Arabic, and that's their job. They operate all sorts of things going on in there that we can't talk about over an open line. And generally they know, somehow, that this guy is going to be in a particular place at a particular time, and they have to go get him. And they always get an army unit that comes with them to sort of be a malavet, to escort them, to make sure, you know, just in case something happens. And it happened to be that that night was our turn, so I get a call, I was the officer on duty, I get a call about 2 o'clock in the morning, we got to assemble a squad of 6 guys, so there's always a roster who's next up in line, so, you know, we wake up the 6 guys, we get our act together, get our gear together, and next thing we know we're in a couple jeeps and we're heading into Ramallah. Now the reason they do this in the middle of the night is because Arabs generally go to sleep early, after dark, and they wake up early at dawn. So 2-3 in the morning, that's usually the quietest time. It's actually a little freaky because you go into these places, there's nobody on the streets, totally dark. You have to sort of, there's what's called mishmat laila, night discipline. That means that you turn the volume down on your radios and every Israeli soldier has what's called a diskit, which is like, you know, this, it's basically your serial number and your name, God forbid. In fact, I don't know if you can see this far away, but there's a line down the middle of the diskit, and that's because, God forbid, if something happens to you and they can't recognize you, like you're in a tank and it blows up, etc., they can always find this, right, and identify you. They break off half of it, right, and they always leave half on the body, God forbid, right? So what you do is you put, like what this is, you put camouflage on it, right, and you actually cover this with a shoelace, and you blacken your face, you do all this stuff so that they won't see you, and it's all quiet. And we get to this area, to this house, and the rule is that, you know, that you're in charge until he enters the house, and then he's in charge. That's just how it works. So the first thing you have to do is you have to, you know, sort of recon the area and make sure nothing's waiting for you. Then you have to surround the house, right, so that when he bangs on the door, if the guy makes a bolt for the back door, there's a soldier back there. So we get to these houses, and it turned out that this house was in a row of houses. So you couldn't really surround the house. And when we walked around to the side, so the back of this house was on the edge of a very high stone wall that led out onto a vineyard in a valley below. And it was about, I don't know, a good 50, 60 foot drop into this vineyard, serious drop. And we didn't even know how to get down into this vineyard. And once you're in the area, you have a window of 3-4 minutes, and by that time you're burnt. Like somebody's going to notice you, so you don't have time to get around down into the vineyard. So I decided the only way to sort of do this safely and surround the house was, you know, to put somebody on the roof, okay? And the guy on the roof, I looked on the side, and I saw in the back of this house, the second one in, there was a little balcony on the back. So I figured somebody will jump up on the roof, let themselves onto the balcony in the back, then when we're ready, right, so if a guy gets out the back window, there'll be a guy in the balcony to cover it. The only problem was I looked at the guys we had picked. You know, remember, this is a reserve duty unit, so a lot of these guys are older, and they've, you know, they were in the Yom Kippur War and whatever. And I realized most of these guys, you know, I mean, they hadn't seen the color of their socks in a long time. And it was very clear the only one who was going to be able to climb up on this roof was me. So fine. It's a little bit of a problem because you don't have an extra radio. And it means that I'm the commander and I'm going to be a little out of sight. But okay. So I said to the shabaknik, listen, just make sure. I want you to wait 3 full minutes before you bang on the door. I don't want to be up on the roof when you bang on the door because that'll be a problem. You don't want this guy to think that he can get away. You'll be forced to kill him. And they need the intelligence. Fine. So I get up on the roof. And I'm lowering myself down onto the balcony. And you know, from the side, it looked like not a big deal. But when you're up on the roof, and there's like a 50, 60 foot drop into a valley, turned out that this balcony was really just like for laundry or something. It was literally this thin. And it was much lower down than it looked from the side. And to let myself down, you know, I was like pouring myself over the side and holding from the roof. And my feet were nowhere near this balcony. It was like a 5-6 foot drop into this balcony. And I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to do this. Because if you miss, right, or you sort of hit the back of the balcony and fall backwards, you're going 40-50 foot down into the dark. That's the end of your day. You know what I mean? So I'm trying to figure out how I'm doing this and what the heck I'm doing there and how I got myself into this. When all of a sudden I hear, you know, this like banging on the door. This guy basically jumped the gun, or maybe he heard a noise inside, and he was banging on the door before I was ready. So all of a sudden I hear noises inside. Now mind you, I'm hanging from the roof. Okay? There's a window right in front of my face that comes out onto this balcony. Okay? It's like below me sort of here, but it's a big window. Right? And the lights go on, and the next thing I know, the curtains open, this guy opens the window, thank God it opened in, and he sees me like 6 inches away from his face, okay? And he looks at me, and I look at him, of course I realize, you know, all he has to do is push. That's all he has to do. If he pushes me, I'm finished, right? And he obviously has a way to get down off this balcony, so that's it. So my heart goes like down into my feet. Right? No idea what to do. Now, of course, in the movies, this isn't a problem. Because in the movies, right, Rambo hangs from one hand and he's got his gun in the other. But in real life, you've got your gun slung over your back and your gear. There's like nothing you can do. Right? So I look at the guy and I say, Ahlan, you know, which means hello. And he looks at me and closes the window. Mamash nisim nisim. And then they stormed into the room and they got him and they found the whole arms cache and whatever else. And I think about that story sometimes because that's sometimes how life is. You're hanging in the air. And you don't really know where you are. And you're not really sure where you're going. And I'll give you an example of what my question is. By the way, just out of curiosity, okay? If I had to pick sort of the topic that you guys hang with, it would be actually a very simple question, right? Do you consider yourselves a Jewish American or an American Jew? Let's define for the moment that an American Jew is a person who's a Jew, happens to be he's in America, but he's a Jew. He could be an English Jew, he could be an American Jew, but he's a Jew first. That's what's important. A Jewish American is a person who's an American, happens to be he's a Jewish American, right? But he could have been a Muslim American or Christian American. So do you consider yourselves American Jews or Jewish Americans? And just, I'm just curious, if you think that you're an American Jew, right, which means that what's sort of, as a Jew, that's what counts, then raise your hand. Everybody here thinks you're a Jew? I'm curious. So, right, so you think, Albert, you think, you consider yourself an American Jew. Who here thinks of yourself first as a Jewish American? Anybody? Okay. So this is an interesting. Okay. So this is an interesting question. Where do you hang on this question? Okay. So keep. Put that question in one corner of your mind. We might not get back to that question. I don't know if we'll have the time. But you know, if not, you'll get a chance to sort of talk about it afterwards. And let me ask you another question. Okay. You know, Memorial Day is a very difficult day from a number of perspectives. And I'll give you an example. I'll give you an example. When I came to Israel, I went to Gush, I was in Yeshiva, and I decided to stay Shana Bet. I knew already I was going to go into the army, but I didn't feel I was ready, and I wanted to learn, and I also wanted to get to know the Israelis, so I decided to stay a second year. And I decided that I wanted to get to know the guys that I was going in with. They were like a year younger than me. They were Shana Aleph, right? You know, first year guys. So every night, and of course I had my friends, Americans, you know, we used to hang out. But every night at dinner, I decided I would go sit at one of the Israeli tables, and I would get to know some of the guys that I was going to be going into the army with. Okay. This was a disastrous experiment. All right? Basically, I knew very little Hebrew, and these guys knew very little English, and most of our conversations consisted of like, could you please pass the sugar and, could I have some chicken and whatever else it was. And I kind of felt a little bit like an idiot. I was sitting there with these guys, and they were all close with each other, and I didn't really have much to do with them. And my friends, you know, they would ask me, like, well, why are you sitting with those guys? Like, you know, come sit with us. Like, well, what's up with that? I said, well, you know, I'm going in. I want to get to know them. Anyway, after like a couple months of this, whatever it was, one night, we're sitting at the table, and the ringleader, like there was one guy at the table, he was clearly like the ringleader, and he was like a very good-looking guy, tall, blonde, blue eyes, you know, whatever. And he was very funny. He would always crack jokes. All the guys would laugh, and I would go, ah, but I had no idea what he was saying, right? And one night he looks at me, he goes, Atatislachli, you know, forgive me, aval ma ata oseh po? Like, what are you doing here? Why do you come sit here every night? Right? And I was like in shock. I mean, right? And I'm like, you know, sort of getting my dishes anyway. It's the end of dinner, so I pick up my tray, you know. I said, well, I'm going into the army with you, and I thought I would get to know you guys. I thought this was a good idea, but I guess I was wrong. And I walked away, and I think, all right, I'm done with this. I'll either get to know these guys in the army or I won't. So the next day, this guy comes over to me in the Beis Medrash, and he says, listen, you know, I was thinking, if you're going into the army with us and you want to get to know us, why don't we set up a chavruta? You know, let's find the time to learn together. We'll get to know each other. So I thought that was great. You know, finally somebody, you know, like I broke the ice, right? So I said, okay, great. So we talked for a minute, and he said, well, the only time that I have free time, because I have a lot of different chavruta, is at 1:30. But if you're willing to learn at 1:30, so I'm willing to learn at 1:30. We can try it. So I'm like, oh God, 1:30. Like, the day in Gush is a very intense day. You wake up at 6 in the morning, you have minyan at 6:30, you have morning seder and shir until lunch at 1, you have mincha at 3, after mincha you have afternoon seder and classes until 7:15, then you have marav and dinner, then you have night seder at 8:15 until like 11, guys usually stay in the Beis Medrash until midnight. This is a very long day. The only free time you have in your day is at 1:30 after lunch. And that's usually the time that you go and you play some basketball, take a nap if you want. So I'm like, to give that up. But I figure, like, if I'm serious and I want to get to know these guys, I'm fine. So I said, okay, fine. So after lunch, I come back to the Beis Medrash and I'm waiting there, 1:30, quarter to 2, 2:00, 2:15, nothing. Guy doesn't show up. I'm getting really ticked off, right? And finally, you know, I'm not going to go back to my room at this point, so I stay till mincha. After mincha, I go find him, okay? And he's sitting in the back, you know, learning with someone. I said, what happened? So he looks at me and goes, what are you talking about? You know? I said, Matali, you know, you said that we would learn at 1:30. And I was here. So he looks at me and says, 1:30. He says, no. I didn't mean 1:30 in the afternoon. I have a chavruta in the yeshuv. I meant 1:30 in the morning. So my mouth dropped open. I said, 1:30 in the morning? Are you out of your mind? But, you know, I wanted to get to know him, so that's what we started doing. We started learning 1:30 in the morning. And from that day on, he made it his personal mission to take me around to all the 50, 60 guys in our machzor, introduce me to each one of them. Every time there was like a birthday party, every time there was a hike, every time there was like somebody was doing something, every time that when we went on chofesh, he made sure that I was included. And I got, you know, I started to get to know the guys. I actually fought to be in the same unit with him. It didn't work out for different reasons. And we became very close. And his name was Danny. And just so you understand what kind of a guy this was, he became famous because he was in the newspapers. We were up in Lebanon. We were actually in different places. And because by this point I was already in sergeant's course, and he was in near a place called Gesher Kasmiya. There are beautiful, beautiful cherry orchards in Lebanon. I mean, Lebanon is a beautiful country. It's such a sad thing that it's been at war for so long. And he suddenly realized, you know, and guys would go on patrol, and there's this huge no man's land area, wherever the border is, you know, at this point, below the Beirut-Damascus highway, and there are these beautiful cherry orchards. So guys would walk, and they would sort of pick cherries off the tree and eat them. So he started to wonder, whose cherries are these? I mean, they must belong to somebody. It's an orchard. So are you allowed to take cherries off the trees and eat them? Maybe it's gezel, maybe you're stealing. So all the guys thought he was nuts. Now back then, there were no cell phones. He managed to organize a landline and called up Rav Amital, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Gush, of Har Etzion, to ask him this shaila. Now, by the way, it happens to be that it was usur, that it was forbidden, because there's no assumption that this guy gave up, and you don't know who the guy is, and even if it's a non-Jew, for whatever the reasons. So Rav Amital asked him, no, in fact, it's gezel, you shouldn't take them. So can you imagine? He made it his mission to go around to all the guys in the unit and tell them they shouldn't eat the cherries. And this was a Hezder unit. These were guys in yeshiva who served in the army together. I remember in between our services, I was in Gush, and I was walking by the telephone. Okay? They were like payphones. And I was on my way to shir, Because I started out with Hesder until I became an officer, which means that you do a certain amount of army time, a certain amount of yeshiva. So I got back to yeshiva for a few months to learn before I was going back to officer's course. And I walk by the payphones and I see Donnie is standing there on the phone. Only he's giggling. He's got like this funny body language like you have when you talk to a girl on the phone, right? And I was like, okay, this was interesting because I knew he had a new girlfriend, but he was very private about this stuff. You know, he was really into like learning and stuff. So he didn't talk about it much. So I was really curious. I think I'd go over and start ragging him. So I walked over to him. And I realized, this guy is talking in perfect English. So my mouth drops open. And I stand there staring at him. And he turns around and he sees me, flashes me one of his smiles. You know, he was a great smile. And, you know, like flashing, you know, twinkling eyes. And he goes back to the phone, whatever. So I wait there and he finishes his conversation. He comes over. I said to him, you speak English? He said, sure, I speak English. I said, you speak perfect English? He said, yeah, you know my parents are from England. I said, I can't believe you speak perfect English. All these years I've been breaking my teeth on Hebrew the last couple of years and you speak perfect English? So he puts his hand on my shoulder. He says to me, if I would have spoke to you in English, you would never have learned Hebrew. That was Danny. In 1984, on the 19th of Adar, I was actually in officer's course. It's a long story, but I got noticed that he was in an ambush in Gesher Kasmia, and along with Didi Cohen, who was another friend of ours, he was killed in the ambush. I want you to know his father is a shell of who he once was. He's never been the same. It's like the light went out in his eyes. I never really understood this until I got married. We have a thing amongst the guys that we always invite him. We always invite the families of the guys that we've lost to our simchas, you know. So we invited his parents to our wedding and they came. And after the chuppah, they made their excuses. You know, they had to go. I went over to say goodbye, whatever. And I realized from the conversation that they weren't going because they had anywhere to go. It was too painful for them to stay. And that's when it really hit me. See, they weren't at my wedding. They were at Dani's wedding. And they weren't looking at me under the chuppah. They were thinking of Dani. Who was the girl that he was meant to meet that he never met? Who were the children he was supposed to have that he never had? Who were the grandchildren they were supposed to have who would never bounce on their knees? And that's one family. And this Monday on Yom HaZikaron, every family goes back to their personal hell. And the entire country stops to remember. In fact, it's very difficult. Some people, you know, sort of ask, why don't they make Yom HaTzmaut a different day? It's such a celebration. And people go nuts in this country on Yom HaTzmaut. Because before you celebrate what it is that we have to celebrate, you have to take a moment to remember, to appreciate how many gave up how much so that we could have what we have. So that we could just get on a plane and go to Israel. Which leaves me with an interesting question. So what does it mean to remember? Or what does that mean to remember? You have a mitzvah to remember. Let me ask you a question, just out of curiosity. What mitzvot can you think of where there's actually a mitzvah to remember? Give me a couple of examples. There are a number of them. Give me a couple of examples. Pardon? Okay, Yitziat Mitzrayim. Amalek. What? Shabbat. One of you. Josh. You got Amalek. You got Yitziat Mitzrayim. Give me one more. Josh, you look so thoughtful. You're like pensively considering the possibilities. No? Can you think of another example? Ezra, give me an example. I love doing that. Now three of you can think of Ezra in the back. New, what's another example? Something you remember all the time. Every week.
Shabbat.
Zachorat Yom HaShabbat. Now let me ask you a question. How do you fulfill this mitzvah? How do you fulfill the mitzvah of Zachor? Right? We have a mitzvah to remember Yitziat Mitzrayim. How do you fulfill that mitzvah? Like when we think of remembering, we think of like, wow, I remember. So you just sit in your head. But this mitzvah is not just in your head. You have to fulfill it somehow. So how do you fulfill the mitzvah? Yeah?
There's two different ways that we learned about. It's like one's the path and one's like just to think about it.
Okay.
Verbalization.
Okay, to verbalize. That's, by the way, a very interesting thing. The Sefer HaChinuch says, if you look in the Sefer HaChinuch, in the mitzvot, when you get to the portion, to the parasha of Yitro, he actually says that Zachorat Yom HaShabbat is the mitzvah to remember bidvarim. Now, bidvarim can be words. You can also say that dvarim is things. It's an interesting thing that that same word applies to both things. That's because words have a reality. They're tangible. They Hashem created the world through words, right? In fact, how do we fulfill the mitzvah of Zechorot Yom HaShabbat on Shabbat? Anybody know?
Kiddush,
that's right. That's right. So what does that mean? I mean, what does that mean? What does it mean that you remember something? You know when I really got this? I got stuck in the army 1 year for Pesach. Okay? And, you know, at first I was really depressed. I was going to be stuck in the army for the Seder. But, you know, eventually you kind of come to terms with it. It was actually a very interesting experience. We were on this very big base deep in the desert in the Negev, and called Shizafon. And there were about, I don't know, 250, 300 different soldiers that got stuck in that area for Pesach, and they all were on this base. And there was an army rabbi, like an army chaplain, a Rav Tzvai, and he had to run this Seder. You have to imagine, you're talking about Jews from every background you can think of. There were French Jews, there were some English speakers like me, there were Moroccan, Yemenite, guys from like, you know, Europe, there were some Russian Olim, there were, unbelievable, right? Ashkenaz and Sephardim, Edot Mizrach, everybody you can think of. So all night, this Nebuch, this Rav, he had to know everybody's minagim, everybody's customs, so he could figure out sort of how to deal with this, right? So at one point, we're sitting at the table. I don't know, any of you guys from Teman? Any Yemenites? No? More Syrians? Right? Okay. Okay, so I don't know if your Eidah does this, but the Yemenites do this. In the middle of, we get to Halach Ma'anya, right? Halach Ma'anya di'achalu avatana bi'ara de Mitzrayim. This is the bread of our affliction our forefathers ate in Egypt. And all of a sudden I notice that like there's guys like around the room and they're doing this weird thing. Okay? They're like, they're taking their matzah, they're putting it in this sort of napkin, they're sort of wrapping it up, taking the napkin, they throw it over their shoulder, right? And then they stand up, right? Okay? And they start dancing. They're like back and forth, and you know, right? And they start singing this weird thing, like, right? And I'm thinking, like, you know, we're like in Cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs land, right? That's what I'm thinking. And what were they doing? Okay, instead of just remembering Yitziat Mitzrayim, they were reliving it. You see, Zachor, to remember in Judaism, it's about trying to re-experience. So, if Yom HaZikaron is a day when we remember, what it means is that we're trying to capture an experience. What is the mitzvah of that day? You know? And it leads you to a second question. And the second question has to do with Yom HaTzmaut. Okay? What is Yom HaTzmaut? So Yom HaTzmaut is the day, in 1917... Okay, by the way, just before I get into this, and then we'll open up the floor. Anybody have any questions so far? Anything?
We're good.
We're good? Okay. So, in 1917, the British came to this part of the world. And they basically found a mess, right? It was the end of World War I, and they had promised this state to the Arabs, to the Jews. They had to sort of make sense of it. So they were given a mandate by what was then the League of Nations, okay? And it took them 30 years to realize they couldn't figure it out. So they gave it back to what became the United Nations. United Nations sent a fact-finding mission to Israel, what was then Palestine. They came back with a recommendation that this place be partitioned into two separate states. One for the Arabs, one for the Jews. I'm not going to get into the politics of it for the moment. Famous vote, November 29th, 1947. The United Nations, the only good thing they've ever done, the United Nations voted to give the Jewish people a state, a homeland in the state of Israel. Right? It's an interesting question why Hashem worked these things out, that the United Nations was involved in this. Rav Soloveitchik, if you know who that was, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, has an interesting theory. There's a Gemara that says that, it's an Agadata, you don't learn halacha from it, but there's a Gemara that says that one of the Shvuot, one of the oaths that supposedly the Jewish people swore when they went into exile, when they went into Galut, was Shaloy Alu Bachoma. Right? We were sworn by Hashem, as it were, that we would never buck the nations of the world, that until they gave us back the land of Israel, that we were not allowed to come home. There are still many Jewish communities that believe, therefore, many, that believe that it's wrong to come to Israel, that it was wrong to create a state of Israel, because after all, the Gemara says, Shelo yalu b'choma, you're not allowed to come back to Israel until Hashem brings us home, right? And you could have a big debate on that. It's an interesting question. You know, is that an agarata? Do you learn halacha from that? But whatever. Rav Soloveitchik's response to that was, that's why Hashem created the United Nations. He certainly didn't create it for anything they've done since. Right? The United Nations basically is the answer to Shelo yalu b'choma. The world actually said you can have a state of Israel, which is an amazing thing, but for another time. So the British announced that if the United Nations decided the Jews are going to have a state and the Arabs are going to have a state, then we don't need to be here. We can go home. So they announced it on May 15th, 1948. They're packing up their bags, going back to England. Okay? The Jews announced that on May 15th, actually May 14th, because May 15th was Shabbos, they didn't want to declare the state of Israel on Shabbos. So on Friday afternoon, May 14th, right, they're going to declare the state of Israel. And the Arabs announced that on the day the Jews declare the state of Israel, once the British leave, because the Arabs couldn't attack before the British left, because then they'd be attacking British sovereign territory. They didn't want to go to war with England. But as soon as the British leave and the Jews declare their state, this is going to be the shortest lived state in the history of the world. Okay, it'll last about 3 hours. We'll all march in and we'll create the state of the Jews 6 feet into the Mediterranean and 6 feet under. Now, the Arab armies outside of Israel had to wait until the British left, but the Arabs inside of Israel had no such problem, and so the War of Independence began. And by the way, you can go to the actual building in Tel Aviv, called Heichal HaAtzmaut, right? It's an interesting story that it has, where this group got together, right? You know, it's an interesting question. We were in the middle of a war, and they wanted to gather together the who's who of what would become the state of Israel to declare the state. You can imagine everybody wanted to be there. So they suddenly realized that they would be gathering the entire leadership of the Jewish people in Israel, the heads of the army, the heads of politics, in one building. So if the Arabs would find out about this, all they had to do was bomb that building, and there goes the Jewish state. So it was basically done under great secrecy. They sent out invitations to 300 individuals, and on the invitation it actually says secret, top secret, and don't tell anybody, right? But on this day we're going to declare a state and you're invited. Well, of course, you send a Jew an invitation, tell him not to tell anybody. Tens of thousands of people showed up on this day. Right? The whole world knew about it, right? Security out the window, and they declared a state. It's actually an amazing thing to go stand in this room, right? And it's an interesting debate whether you could make a bracha in such a place. It's an interesting question, but whatever. And they declared the state of Israel. And that's the day that Israel chose to commemorate as Yom HaAtzmaut. Right? Now, I'm putting aside the whole question of what Yom HaAtzmaut is and the problem with the fact that it's, you know, during Sfirat HaOmer and all that stuff. That's a very interesting topic, but I'll leave you guys to discuss that. I have only one question. Why do we need a Jewish state? Why do we need a Jewish state? So we don't have a Jewish state. Okay? I'm asking you this question. Why do you think we need a Jewish state? Maybe you don't think we need a Jewish state. Why do we need a Jewish state? The floor is yours. Why do we need
it?
What?
Hashem wants us to have it.
Well, why does Hashem want us to have it? Let me ask you a question. Let's say that you're a talented musician. I mean, let's say that you have a gift, right? You know, you may not be good at math, and you may not even be good at Gemara, but you discover that when you pick up a guitar, a violin, you're unbelievable. You know, when you were 3 years old, you were playing Beethoven concertos. So that means Hashem wanted you to have that gift. Okay, now you got to figure out what to do with it. You got to figure out what to do with it. Why did Hashem give you this gift? Right? It's hard to say that He gave you this gift just so you'd be able to tell people I have this gift. You have to decide what to do with it. And like any other gift, right, you can decide, oh, we're in Israel. Now let me just, hang on. Okay. I'm sorry about that. I just, for obvious reasons, I have to make sure not to stay out of touch. So we were given a gift. I mean, for 2,000 years, the Jewish people dreamed about having a home that they could call their own. And now we have it. Our generation is lucky enough to have it. Why do we need it? Why do you need a state of Israel? Why do you need a Jewish state? Why were so many Jews so fanatical about building a state of Israel? Anybody? Okay, I will buy that. Okay, Albert, right? I will buy that. Who was that? Where? Raise your hand. It's hard to tell. It's hard to tell who's talking. So who said that? Zach? Zach, okay. So I'll buy that on the I'll buy that on the one hand. On the other hand, that presents me with a certain problem. Okay? First of all, I understand that in 1948, the Jewish people had no choice. We had nowhere to go. There were hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews that were that were wallowing in the DP camps in Europe, and they had nowhere to go. Eastern Europe was a Jewish graveyard. In fact, Jews that stayed in Poland had pogroms. I don't know if you know this, Jews were killed, were massacred in pogroms in Poland, in Kielce, after the Holocaust. Jews came back to their homes in Germany and were beaten up. They had nowhere to go. America closed her doors. As much as I love America and as much as America, I have tremendous gratitude and hakarat hatov for what America did for the Jewish people. In 1945, America closed their doors. They were terrified of a huge wave of immigration. There was nowhere to go. So we had to have a place to go. We had to be sure that the Holocaust would never happen again. That I understand. We had no choice. But you know what? Today you have lots of choices. You have lots of choices. You can even go back to Germany. There's a large Jewish community today in Germany. I mean, let's be honest here. Do you really think that in Deal, New Jersey, that there's a Holocaust coming? Do you think that your children are not going to be safe? If you really thought that your children would not be safe in America, you would come to Israel. Right? Ethiopians come to Israel. But there's lots of places Jews could go. So that's an interesting question. Why do I need a state of Israel? And by the way, on a theological level, I mean, Hashem seems to have given us a mitzvah to be in Israel. Now, you could debate with a Beis HaMikdash, without a Beis HaMikdash. You could imagine my opinion on the topic, right? There's a big debate. Is it one of the Tariag mitzvot? Is it not one of the mitzvot? So the Ramban actually goes so far, to say that that any mitzvah that you do in Chutz Laretz, right, out of Israel, is only a zecher. That you, if you live in America your whole life, and put tefillin on every day, that you're not fulfilling the mitzvah of tefillin midaraisa from the Torah. You're only doing it so that you don't forget the mitzvah when you come back to Israel. Now the Rambam, by the way, the Rambam does not list living in Israel as one of the mitzvot. Some people say that's because it's not a mitzvah. Some people say that's because it's such an essential mitzvah that it doesn't need to be part of the minyan mitzvah. That's a big debate. But if there's a mitzvah to live in Israel, why? Why do you need to be in Israel? So I'll give you something to think about. And then we'll open up the floor. Okay? You know, and this, now we're getting into the realm of opinion. You know, as a rule in learning, the question is usually better than the answer. So I'll tell you where I'm at on the question. Okay? But if nothing else comes out of this, but that you struggle with this question and you think about it, then that'll be worthwhile. Okay? Because Israel, and not necessarily the state of Israel, like, you know, the state of Israel is far from perfect. There are a lot of problems in the state of Israel. And I personally have no issue with a person who struggles with, you know, anybody who thinks that the state of Israel means that we've arrived and Geulah has come is just whistling Dixie. On the other hand, to imagine that after 2,000 years, you know, that Hashem gave us, sort of a Jewish sovereignty in Israel and that we don't have to have Hakarat HaTov, I also have difficulty with that. How you do that, that's an interesting question. Right? But if that's a gift, and clearly we've been given that gift, our generation has been given that gift, so then we have to struggle. So what do we do with that gift? That's an interesting question. So I'll give you something to think about. Okay? You know, I'll tell you one last story. Okay? And then I'll open up the floor. Any questions you have? There was a mission in Lebanon. This is already a good 6, 7, 8 years ago. This is a very difficult story. This story, by the way, is an exception to the rule, thank God. It is an exception to the rule. It is not the norm, but it sent shockwaves through the entire military establishment of the Israeli army. There was a mission in Lebanon. It was actually a unit of Commando Yami. Commando Yami, the naval commandos, that's like the equivalent of the Navy SEALs in America. It's a serious unit. And these guys have to sign on. In order to be in this unit, you have to sign on for 5 years, not 3. They train for the better part of 2 years. They become like brothers. And they were sent deep into Lebanon to take out a Hezbollah position. This is a good number of years ago. There's a tradition in the Israeli army that any mission that goes into enemy territory, that you always have a very high-ranking officer who oversees the mission. It's his job to approve the training schedule. It's his job to approve the roster. And he's the one who gives the final go, no-go. In this particular case, the officer in charge of this mission, overseeing the mission, not going to be on the ground, was a fellow by the name Effie Etam, Effie Fine, who was a very high-ranking officer in the Israeli army. He eventually became a lieutenant general. He was actually the highest-ranking officer with a kippah on his head ever in the Israeli army before he left the army. Unfortunately, he went into politics. That's another story. And so he was overseeing this mission. So because he was overseeing this mission, there's actually a tradition that, you know, if you're going to send guys into harm's way, you be there when they go and you send them off. That's not a rule, but that's a tradition. Like, that's just what you do. And so he was on the chapak, he was on the helicopter that was sort of over the area, sort of managing the battle from afar. And he was with the boys when they were dropped into Lebanon, right? And he was going to be there waiting for them when the helicopters came back, when they returned. Anyway, these guys head into Lebanon. Something went very wrong. To this day, we don't know exactly what happened. We're almost positive it was not an intelligence leak. Maybe it was blind luck. Maybe they monitored some frequencies. Nobody's sure. But all of a sudden, these guys, you know, all hell broke loose, right? The night turned into day. They shot up flares. They opened fire on them. You know, in the movies, when you see this happen, you think like, you know, you're in the dark and it's scary to be in the dark. It's not true. When you're out in enemy territory and doing whatever it is you're doing, or, you know, in intifada, so darkness is actually your friend. When you're in the dark and you feel nobody can see you, you feel a little comfort. But the moment when night turns into day, that's a very traumatic experience. There isn't anybody who doesn't freeze. That's just human. And the measure of the man is how quickly you come out of that. This unit did exactly what they were supposed to do. They came under heavy fire. They activated a minefield. The commander of the mission, a captain, was killed on the spot. His second in command was blown up in the air and thrown into a ditch. He ended up dying by the time they got him back to the helicopter later. The third in command, because there's always a chain of command that's automatic, you decide on that sort of beforehand. First sergeant, veteran, he takes over. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. He split up his unit into two. He set up a koch retek, a cover fire position. He took the unit that was going to charge up the hill, you know, sort of under cover fire. And everybody knew what they were supposed to be doing. And they started to do what they were supposed to do. Now, one of the guys that's supposed to be in the group that's charging up the hill, that's sort of what's called kitzur tvachim, to make the distances close enough that you can get there, was carrying a Negev heavy machine gun. A Negev heavy machine gun, it's Israeli manufactured, it has an extremely rapid rate of fire, it is absolutely the weapon of choice when you're firing up a hill like that, and you can't do a hystarut, you can't charge up a position without him. This boy, whose name was Ofer, unfortunately this hit the press, for some reason did not charge up the hill. Over the radio, the sergeant realizes the Negev isn't there and starts screaming at him to follow them up the hill. And he refuses. At this point, the first sergeant is killed. He's cut down by fire from the hill. Effie Fine, listening on the radio line, realizes enough is enough and recalls the mission. Thank God they managed to collect the three bodies, all of them dead by the time they get on the helicopter, and make it safely back to Israel. When they land on the tarmac back in Israel, Effie Fine is waiting for them. You have to debrief a unit like this. You can't begin to imagine. There aren't that many units like this in the Israeli army. You can't afford to lose one. So the nine guys that are left, you have to give them the opportunity to express themselves, to talk about it and what went wrong, and to realize it's not their fault, whatever else it is. So they're sitting in the briefing room, and they're going through the tahkir, and Israel takes this very seriously. There's a kabban, a ktzin briyut nefesh, an army psychiatrist, there's a social worker, and there's sort of officers doing whatever. And at one point, they get finally to the point in the mission, and Effie Fine looks at Ofer, and he says to him, Makala, what happened? I mean, you have to understand, this is an elite army unit, a soldier refusing a direct order, under fire, in enemy territory. It does not get worse than that. What happened? So the guy looks at Effie Fine. He says to him, I want you to know that I knew with absolute certainty that if I charged up that hill, I was going to die. And I was not willing to die for a stinking piece of land in Lebanon. That was his answer. Now, thank God that is the exception to the rule. And unfortunately, this leaked to the press. This sent shockwaves through the Israeli military. Why? Because what was the problem? This boy stopped believing in his mission. And if you don't believe in your mission, you will never succeed in it. You learn this as an officer. I had an officer I was very close with who basically, he was like a legend in tanks, and he trained me when I became an officer. And at the end of officer's course, when it was all over, he told me something that has stuck with me ever since. Officer training, officer school, all that stuff took me a year to get through it. He said, that's all nonsense. That's just an introduction. The real measure of as an officer, can you become the man whose men will follow him anywhere? You cannot get men to follow you up a hill, under fire, into a terrorist enclave to take out terrorists, unless each one of them completely believes in what it is that they're doing. So that raises a difficult question. See, I think that if you ask the average Jew today, and the average Israeli today, do we need a Jewish state? I think they'll all say yes. Most of them will say yes. But if you ask them why, I'm not so sure most people know the answer. So why do we need a Jewish state? So I'll tell you one thing. You know, just like every human being has a purpose. Every human being is born with a purpose, right? Every nation has a purpose. You know, we call ourselves Am Nivcha, right? What do we say every time you go up to the Torah? Every morning, Asher Bachar Banu Mikol Amim. Hashem chose us from amongst all the nations. We are the chosen people, right? Some people have a problem with that term. You know, it sounds very racist, ethnocentric, we're better than everybody else. So I'll let you in on a little secret, and you could debate this afterwards amongst yourselves. I don't personally think that being chosen means you're better than anybody else. In fact, it's very interesting. You know, the Muslim calendar starts when Islam came to the world. The Christian calendar, right? You live in a Christian country. And the calendar of your Christian country, right? Well, it's not really yours, but you may think it's yours, right? It starts with the birth of Yashka, with the birth of Jesus, right? Not the Jewish calendar. The Jewish calendar does not start with the Yetziat Mitzrayim, when the nation was born. The Jewish calendar starts with the creation of humanity. Because the goal of the Jewish people has always been a better world. Right? So every nation is chosen. The fact that Hashem created, in fact, each one of us is chosen. Right? I have four children from Nainara. I don't think any one of them is better than the other, but I think every one of them is chosen. Their challenge is going to be to figure out what they're chosen for. So just like individuals are chosen, nations are chosen. We're chosen. We have something to give to this world. Right? Now, by the way, what is the mission of the Jewish people? Right? What's the goal of Judaism? If you had to pick one word, what do you think the goal of Judaism is? One word. To be what? What's the goal of the Jewish people? What's the goal of Judaism? Why do you need Judaism? No? Anybody? Anybody, what's the goal? Why do we need Jews? Here I'm talking about Israel. What do we need Jews for? Yeah, Josh?
Righteousness.
I'm not saying that's not important. And I'm not saying that's not part of what the Jewish people are here to give to the world. But I don't think that's the goal of Jewish people. I think that's an inevitable result of what the goal of the Jewish people is. New? What's the goal? Anybody know? Yeah? Albert?
Torah.
Well, Torah, actually, it's interesting. Torah is not the goal. Torah is the vehicle. You can't do what it is that we want to do without Torah and mitzvot. But Torah is not the goal. In fact, we get to Har Sinai, right? But then we leave it. We don't stay at Har Sinai. We have to take Torah with us to do what? V'lechtecha baderech. What's the goal? So I'll tell you what the goal is. So, yeah?
Serve God.
To serve God.
Serve God.
Avodat Hashem. Okay, I think that's more along the lines. I would say, by the way, although I think we're probably saying the same thing, I think the goal is Kedusha. Right? Kedoshim to you. The goal is to be Kadosh. What does it mean to be Kadosh? What is Kedusha? So I'll ask you what Kedusha is, you'll tell me holiness. But what does holiness mean? It's really not complicated. Something becomes Kadosh when it becomes a vehicle for bringing Hashem into the world. Right? You can take a, you know, here, this is a good example. Okay? This is an M16. Okay? Right? Is this halal? Is this profane? Or is this kadosh? Okay? Is this, yeah, there's no cartridge, don't worry. If this is used, God forbid, to kill somebody, to murder somebody, then this is halal, this is profane. You can't build a Beis HaMikdash with a weapon of war. But if this is used to save human lives, if this is part of Tzva Hagana Yisrael, then this becomes kadosh. That's why there are many poskim that say that not only are you allowed to carry a gun on Shabbat if you need to, it's actually a mitzvah. It's an interesting question. So kedusha is when something becomes a vehicle for bringing Hashem into the world. You can take a glass of wine, and you can turn into you can end up in the gutter. You can make an idiot out of yourself. I had a friend who was in a yeshivat shalavim, and he got so drunk one year on Purim that he actually thought he was a dog. He started going around pretending he was a dog. And then he passed out, right? This is a guy who should not be drinking, but that's another discussion. This is years ago. Anyway, the next day, guys came over to him, you know, and everybody was looking at him funny. He says, like, what's going on? And they said to him, you don't remember? He said, no. He said, you're kidding me. He said, well, you have to go over to the Rosh Hashiva and apologize. I said, Rosh Hashiva and apologize? What are you talking about? Turns out this guy thought he was a dog, and then he went and proposed to the Rosh Hashiva's daughter. Okay? On Purim. Didn't remember anything. You can take a cup of wine, and you can become chol. You can be profane. Or you can take a cup of wine, and you can elevate your Shabbos meal and make kiddush. And that can become a vehicle for experiencing Hashem in this world. And if that's true about an individual, it's true about a people. Our goal is to be an Or LaGoyim, to bring Kedusha in the world. I'll give you one example. And with this we'll end, and I'll open up the floor to anything on your mind. In 1982, the Israeli army crossed the border into Lebanon. It's a longer story. You can Google the web and see the whole story. First Lebanon War. They say this summer was the second Lebanon War. I personally think it's one Lebanon War, but fine. 20,000 troops crossed the border, invaded a sovereign country. For what I think were the right reasons, but we could debate that. For the next 20 years, they say that over 250,000 men served significant time in Lebanon. In all of that time, including this summer when we were at war, 250,000, it's probably closer to 300,000 by now, men have been in Lebanon for serious periods of time. There is not one reported case of rape. Not one. There was never a claim of rape. Not from the Red Cross, not from the Arab Red Crescent Society, no terrorist group, nobody. Not one. I challenge any army in the world to stand up to that statistic. And don't get me wrong, we have our challenges and the things in the army that need to be fixed. But in that statistic, the Israeli army became a Jewish army. That's what it's supposed to be. So why do we need a state? Because you can't be a nation unless you have a land. And you can't be a light unto the nations, to the world, unless you're visible in your place. I'm putting aside, by the way, what Eretz Israel is and the Kedusha of Eretz Israel and why this place with its history and all that we accomplished and all of the energy that came to this land from Avram and Yitzchak and all of that and why this place is an environment. You know, it's not accidental that when you have minyan in your school, you don't do it in the gym, you do it in the Beis Medrash. Because that place has a little more conducive energy to davening. And you don't play basketball in the kitchen, you play basketball in the basketball court. Right? So what that really means and what you do with that is an interesting question. But the reason we need a Jewish state is because the Jewish people can never be, we can never become all that we're meant to be unless we're home in the land of Israel with a Melech and a Sanhedrin and a Beit HaMikdash and everything else. And we are the generation that's blessed enough to begin at least to see the glimmerings of what this could be. So that's a little bit of food for thought on Yom HaZikaron and Yom HaAtzmaut. I hope that this Monday at 11 in the morning, maybe your time, but certainly if you're awake at 11 in the morning Israel time, right, when the entire country here stops, you should think about maybe that you should take a moment as well, learn Mishnayos, whatever it might be. And I want to wish everybody a really meaningful Yom HaZikaron and a powerful Yom HaAtzmaut. And now, just, you know, any questions that you have. By the way, one last thing, because yesterday I forgot and Rabbi Krugman asked me to mention this, that we do put out a weekly Parsha Byte, which is basically an army story or something like that, and a thought on the Parsha. If you're interested in it, I'm more than happy to send it to you. I will send Rabbi Krugman, who organized this whole program, an email, and your Rabbeim can get you an email, whatever it might be. If you want, by the way, to email me, you have questions from the Shir, it's very easy. My email address is Binny, B-I-N-N-Y, at Israelite.org, I-S-R-A-L-I-G-H-T.org. Does anybody have any questions before we say au revoir, or l'hitraot? Anybody, any questions? About anything, the Shir, Israel, the army, whatever you want.
Who was your tank instructor?
My tank instructor? Oh, it wasn't so much my tank instructor. When I was in officer's course, when I got to officer's course, I had come from Hezder. And I had basically been 6 months sort of out of the army. And I was, you know, not Mishufshaf. I wasn't, you know, and then you do like a month of prep, and then you do 3.5 months of infantry training. By the time I got back to tanks, I had just been away from tanks for too long. And, you know, as it was, my Hebrew wasn't good, so I just wasn't cutting it. So it's a long story, but basically they put you through a company commander maneuver, a battalion maneuver, and eventually a brigade maneuver to test you, because they're not sending out an officer unless they think he's up to speed. In the end, about 3 days before the end of the course, they finally decided, even though they liked me and everything else, they couldn't, with all conscience, send me out to be a tank commander. So they failed me. I failed the course. But because I didn't fail on discipline, but just because I wasn't practiced enough, they offered me the chance to do the whole course again. You cannot begin to imagine how depressing it is. It was absolutely the worst course I was ever in my life. It was the most horrible experience. And to do this whole course again, I mean, you're talking about 3 hours a night for another 4 months of sleep. Anyway, I decided that if I didn't do it for the rest of my life, I would regret not doing it. So I went back and did the whole thing again. And 3 nights into the second course, and now, by the way, one of my commanders is now a guy who was with me in the first course, right, who didn't like me. That has a whole other story. It's like something out of a movie, right? So Yuval Azulai was a legend in the tank course. He was a legend. He was just unbelievable. He knew everything there was to know about navigation, tanks, tactics. Unbelievable guy. This guy, if he would have been a religious guy, he could have been Rosh Yeshiva. Mamash a brilliant guy. So he sees me standing in the line 3 days into the course, and he sort of works with the brigade level, and he calls me out of the line at the end of the Mizdar, and he says, Friedman, nachon? So I said, yeah. He says, what are you doing here? And so my heart sank. I was like, oh no, this guy doesn't think I'm professional enough. They're going to kick me out again. I did this for nothing. So I said, well, you know, I always wanted to be an officer, and I think it's the right thing to do, and I don't want to regret it, whatever. So he looks at me, and he puts his nose like this far away from my nose, says to me, I want you to know that I am going to make your life a living hell. That's what he says to me. He says, every night when everybody else finishes, I'm going to take you, and you're going to be mine. So for about a week, I hated his guts. Every night he would test me and all the stuff from that day, and he would drill me, and he would make me run and do all the stuff. It took me about a week to realize that the reason he was doing this was because he was determined that if I was crazy enough to come back and do this whole course again, that this time I was going to pass, right? And he made me his personal mission, okay? And for the next, whatever it was, 3 months, he made my life a living hell. But because of that, I got a tremendous amount out of this course, and I graduated with honors. The last day of the course, there's a, you know, when you get your officer's bars, there's like a sort of a custom in officer's course that your commander comes over and gives you a chapcha. Chapcha is like a slam on the back, but not just like, how's it going? I mean, the officers compete who can throw their cadet the furthest. This is the last they get to do it before you get your bar. So as my officer is about to do this, I hear like a shuffle, and Azulai comes behind me and goes, Lolo, Zesheli, this one's mine, right? And he asked me, he came around, he goes, Nu echze margish, how does it feel to finally finish? So I said, it feels great. And that was when he looked at me in the eye and he said, Atalom evin klum, you understand nothing. He says, you think you're finished? He says, all this, is nothing. This isn't real. He says, now you're going to go out in the field and you're going to discover what it means to be an officer. Blah, blah, blah. So his name was Yuval Azulai. I kept in touch with him for a while, but they eventually went up north. Any other questions? All right, so I wish you guys...
I have a question.
Yes.
I have a question. I hope it's a fair question. I don't know if you deal with similar children and students in Israel as well, but if you had one bite, one message regarding Yom Ha'atzmaut for Israeli students of high school age, what would that be?
For Israeli students?
Yes.
Hakarat Hatov. You know, one of the most important messages in Judaism, I think, is to recognize the gifts you have in this world. It's interesting that when we wake up in the morning, the first tefillah that we say in our day is Modani. You would think you would start your day with a Kadosh Baruch Hu, right? Shema Yisrael, Anochi Hashem Elokecha, that's not how you start your day. The first word in your day is Modeh. Lo doubt, to be thankful. Right? If you could sit on the edge of your bed and make a list of all the things you have in your life to be thankful for, you would never end. And you could never have a bad day. And by the way, mentioned this yesterday, the second word in Modani is the word ani. Do I appreciate myself? Do I know who I am? I have a close relationship with Rav Tversky, if you know who that is, from Pittsburgh, and he lives in Muncie now, and he's very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and all this stuff. He's an amazing fellow. He's a psychiatrist. Anyway, he told me that when he was a boy, his father was the Rebbe. He was really supposed to be the next Bubba of a Rebbe, and he decided people weren't bringing their problems to Rebbeim, they were bringing their problems to, like, you know, the psychiatrist. So he did in that world what you don't do. He was married already. He went to college, he went to medical school, became a psychiatrist. He opened up a center in Pittsburgh, I think called Gateway for Chemical Dependency and whatever. In fact, they call his name is Shia Tversky. They call his followers Shiites. But anyway, so he told me that when he was a kid and his father would get mad at him, he would never say to him, you're bad. Because how could a kid be bad? He would always say to him, it's pasnished, right? It doesn't become you. In other words, you are so good, the action doesn't fit you, right? We have a generation of Israeli kids, especially the ones who are a little less connected, who have been given something on such a silver platter that I'm not sure they always appreciate what it is. You would be amazed. Okay? Over 50% of Israelis have never visited Yerushalayim. They've never been to the Old City. You know, they do a poll every year, like before Hanukkah, asking people questions. People have no idea, you know, whether the, you know, who the Maccabim were and when they came and whether they were Bayit Rishon or Bayit Sheni, etc. So that would be the message. The message would be, you know who you are, discover what you've been given, and decide what you want to do with it. Any other questions?
Thank you very much.
All right, it's a pleasure, guys. Should be well.
I want to thank Rabbi Friedman. Thank you very much.
Pleasure. Come visit us in Israel soon.
This presentation by Rabbi Benny Friedman has been brought to you by Israelite, inspiring a renaissance in Jewish living. To access additional presentations from our online media library, order our best-selling books, or learn more about Israelite programming, including seminars, web-based learning, teleconferences, spiritual retreats, Shabbaton experiences, Israel missions, and leadership training, please visit us at www.israelite.org. That's www.israelight.org. You can also call us in New York at 212-947-4990 or in Jerusalem at country code 972-2-627-4890. We hope you enjoyed this presentation, and we look forward to learning with you at Israelite.